Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true!
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
In October 2013, a 14-year-old boy went missing after leaving his high school in Danvers, Massachusetts. The same evening, his 24-year-old maths teacher was also reported missing. Now, whilst the boy would soon be found alive and well, his teacher would not be so fortunate. The subsequent police investigation would uncover a brutal, senseless murder that would send shockwaves through a community. This is what happens when children kill. This is the murder of Colleen Ritzer. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Whenever I talk about kids that kill, there is a little bit of me that cannot compute it. And I have worked with children who are considered very dangerous. But it's incredibly rare that even when you're working with children that may have been classified with a whole heap of issues and criminality-wise may have engaged in things that you can only imagine engaging in your wildest of nightmares, very rarely do you meet somebody who has that extra potential. The potential to mindlessly, senselessly, and brutally wipe out another human being. Kids do kill. We see that time and time again, but often it's accidental or it's a stabbing that goes wrong, and that is definitely murder. But the reality is, in those scenarios, you can see it's not necessarily something premeditated. And often, even though an individual has carried out a killing using a knife or even a gun at times, the main intention may not have even been to kill. But in cases like the one I'm going to cover today, this is a whole world of pain psychologically for us people out there who have children and no children to genuinely digest and compute. Because what we're talking here is a high level malevolence that is so rare, even in adults. And we're talking about a 14-year-old young man today. 14. It can really help before I start this case to just picture a 14-year-old that you know. How they think, what they say, the way they express themselves. Because I think to contextualize it is really helpful. Yes, it makes it more shocking, but it also means that we can identify a little bit more with how outside the realms of reality this case is today. And how for the family of Colleen Ritzer, it became an absolute reality for them. And in doing so, changed their lives and continue to change their lives for the rest of their life. So in 2013, we've got 24-year-old Colleen Ritzer. She's living with her parents. She's also got two younger siblings in Andover. And she's in her second year as a maths teacher at Danvers High School, Essex County, Massachusetts. She's really bright, clearly. I don't know about you guys, but as somebody who had to repeatedly do their maths GCSE, because it turns out I'm definitely not a genius at any level, numerically, I have a real respect for people who not only are excellent at the subject of maths, but also people who pursue it to share with children, because that's what Colleen does. She shares it with other generations, and that makes her a really important cog in the wheels of life. It's as simple as that. Also, we can additionalize her academic value and intelligence because she was studying for a master's degree at Salem State University. She was really well respected. She was incredibly well loved by her students. She was known to be an inspirational teacher. And I'm highlighting that because that doesn't take away from other people's murders. At the end of the day, nobody should be murdered, whether you were a really nice teacher or a really grotesquely awful teacher, of which there are some. The point is, your life still has infinite meaning. But when we're talking about somebody like Colleen, she's that kind of teacher that inspires young people. And she was also a teacher who noticed young people who were struggling, and she didn't turn away from them. She turned towards them, she reached in. And I say that as somebody who's worked with groups of young people that often in society, shall we say, are not considered embracing worthy. But I've always found those populations of children to be incredibly damaged and incredibly wonderful. They're just often waiting for somebody to see the beauty within them. It might take a particular type of individual to crack that nut, but once you do, it's incredible what you find. But it takes real determination and commitment and a willingness to see beyond the behaviour. And not everyone has that capacity. And I would argue in education, very few have that capacity. But Colleen did. She had it. And that makes her really, really special. She was known for always going out of her way to help the children. And she had this connection with them that inspired them to do better. And the reputation that she carried as a human being was one of being very kind, very compassionate. She'd even stand outside before class so that she could welcome the students that she didn't teach who were passing. And I just think that's something so unique. The fact that she's there, standing outside a classroom, just so she can kind of connect with kids that she's not involved with. Just to say, I noticed you, I value you. That's a real powerful message. Also, she had a sign for students on her whiteboard, and that sign read, "You matter." So she's constantly wanting to share this positivity, but also reflect to every child that she comes into contact with the fact that she sees beyond. And I mean that that is something I respect, because having worked in those populations, many times the young people who are difficult to teach are the ones that we should make great aim to teach. I always say, when I train people in the past in working with difficult young people, it's easy to teach the clever, well-behaved kids. And those clever, well-behaved kids deserve all the respect in the world. And the truth is, life is going to reflect their passion and their progress and their commitment, because they're good, studious kids. But the difficult ones, it can be really easy to abandon them, to reject them. But what you're often doing is you're compounding the pain that they're already suffering. I know there'll be people out there saying, well, when I was 15, I was a little ass and I had a great life. But I'm genuinely saying, from a research perspective, but also an experiential perspective, that very often behavior is pain symptomatic. So it looks like terrible acting out, but when you go beneath it, you actually find that the child is in great emotional pain, or they're dealing with family dysfunction, or they're hungry, or they're just dealing with a life of abuse. And when you write things like "you matter" on the board, and you notice those kids that are maybe a little bit more difficult to notice, for the right reasons, not the wrong ones, you can genuinely change lives. You can deflect one journey that's going in a terrible direction, and you can make it something incredible. And she did that. Also, she was known to have favorite colors. She was somebody who was very feminine, and her favorite color was pink, which is something that Colleen and I would not agree on. I'm more of a favorite color black kind of a person, but it takes all sorts in this world. One thing we would definitely connect on is that her favorite time of the year was Christmas, which should be legitimately everybody's favorite time of year, if only for the overfeeding of ourselves and the excuse to drink alcohol at 11 a.m. in the morning for at least 5 days. Also, when you check out her Twitter feed that she used to post on, she would communicate lessons to students through it. And this is one of the things that she actually wrote. "Math teacher, often too excited about the topics I'm teaching. Passion in teaching genuinely changes the world for children in those lessons." It really does. It makes it so much more accessible and relatable. So that's the background on Colleen, and I think we can all agree that she's a pretty awesome young woman. We get to Tuesday, the 22nd of October. This is 2013. Now, the last class that day, Colleen actually had a math lesson. This was with ninth graders in room 209. In that class, we've got 14-year-old student Philip Chisholm. So what can we say about Philip Chisholm? Well, he was a really keen soccer player. In fact, he was Junior Varsity Squad's leading soccer scorer. But I'd say at this point, little else is known about him. So he's fairly new to the school. But at this point, those who were working with him, teaching him, they considered him a bright individual. They felt he had a particular talent for drawing, had a real interest in languages. One thing that stands out about him is he's 14 years of age, but he's really tall. He's super tall for that age. So he's 6'2". That is really quite tall for a young man of 14. He'd recently moved from Clarksville, Tennessee. That was just a few months before. So July he'd moved, and he'd gone with his sisters and his mother. So we had two sisters, and he moved with his mother and his two sisters from Clarksville, Tennessee, which is going to be something that I think certainly is significant in the way that he views the world. When we go through this and explore it, we're going to be looking for what are the ingredients that could potentially have aggravated particular types of malevolence, negative behaviours, a feeling of anger and aggression and hostility and bitterness against the world. And I think the move is really pivotal. Now, his parents had actually separated from the marriage when he was 2 years of age, but they hadn't finalised the deal. They hadn't essentially established the divorce. And when they moved from Tennessee, this was still going on. His parents were in the middle of a really acrimonious divorce. Just gonna throw it out there. I always think if you leave your partner from a marriage, unless you're gonna reconcile, just get the paperwork done. Things change. You start earning more money. The house you live in accrues value. Throwing it out there, probably best to seal the deal. Anyway, they didn't, and this acrimony is something that you wouldn't have been aware of at 2 years of age, but boy, if you are 14 years of age and you've had to move and you're dealing with all this acrimony with your parents, it's going to have some kind of emotional injury. It can't help but do that. Now, the divorce agreement, that actually only gives his father, Stacey Chisholm, restricted access to his children. Now, this would be due to physical abuse, sexual abuse, or a pattern of emotional abuse. Just gonna throw it out there. I don't think a parent should be given any access to their children if there's physical abuse, sexual abuse, or a pattern of emotional abuse. Are we in clown world where this should even be a clause? Surely, if you are in a scenario where one of your parents is sexually abusing you, physically abusing you, emotionally abusing you to such a degree that it's actually created restricted access, could we just make the restriction permanent? Permanent restriction from access to harming children. Anyway, this is in place, so there is clear dysfunction in the family, and we have to also acknowledge that if this kind of behaviour is being experienced by the children, that is very unfortunate, will have absolute emotional ramifications and internalised, at times, anger. Again, we're going to look for ingredients of possibility that resonate with how this case plays out. So this kind of potential internalisation of anger, a sense of being let down by primary caregivers, and so on and so forth, can certainly additionalize any kind of negative feelings. And those feelings can sometimes remain within. They can sometimes play out in things like self-harm, eating disorders, real low mood, even suicidal behaviors. Or it can become, shall we say, so intolerable to contain that you look for an outlet. Some people might find positive outlets, such as sports, going for long runs, and others may find more dark ways of exposing to the world that pain. Again, I'm not saying that that's actually what happens here. I'm just saying let's look at all the potential ingredients and how that might play out in this crime. Now, according to neighbours in Clarksville, Chisholm had been completely traumatised by the move to Danvers. So he's 14, certainly difficult point in adolescence. We often talk on this channel about the fact that when you're a teenager, there are so many changes. You've got hormonal, relational, educational, physical, without a doubt. Particularly when you're talking about a 6'2" young man. I mean, there's a lot going on body-wise. But also, when you think about a transition of living somewhere that you feel secure, that you know your peers, you're in relationships, to suddenly have that taken away from you, it can be infuriating. You feel like you know everything because you're a teenager. Do you remember what that was like? I wish I knew as much now in my head as I thought I knew when I was 15. I would literally be running the world. The world would be run very badly because obviously I was 15 at the time. And if I was that now, it would only be chaotic and hideous and horrendous. But the point is, the confidence that you have at that age often suggests to you in your teenage brain that you really are somebody who is misunderstood. And if everyone just listened to you, it'd all be fine because you know everything. But let's just relate to that for a minute, because if you suddenly have your control removed and you have to leave an area that you feel happy within and you have to go and start a completely new life and it's totally beyond your control, that can definitely spark this rageful feeling within, because you feel so frustrated that everybody else is getting to choose what happens to you. You're just this recipient of everybody else's decisions, and that can be so infuriating. So these neighbors in Clarksville say that he was really traumatized by that move. He was incredibly popular. He had loads of friends in Clarksville. He even had a girlfriend that he'd known for years. So there are a lot of fundamental breaks in his ordinary experience of a day-to-day life that he'd built. And he's got to start all over again. What I will also note is people who saw him in his new school, new environment, the new peers that he started to relate to, they said, well, you know what? He found it relatively easy. He settled into student life well. It's also worth noting at this point that Chisholm hadn't had any previous criminal record. He's never had a history of violence. He's never had a history of aggression. In fact, he'd never been seen to have any issues with impulse control or with anger management. He wasn't considered to be a problem student at all. So the young man who I'm painting a picture of right now certainly isn't a pen portrait of possibility in a paradigm that is concerning us, is it? This is a guy who, all intents and purpose-wise, is doing really well. He's popular, he's successful, he's liked, he can hold down long-term relationships. This is the kind of kid that you want in your class. But of course, I won't be telling this story unless this was all about to change. And when I say the word escalation, if there was an extreme example of this, we're covering it right now. The classmates who knew Chisholm, they said that he was really quiet. He was really nice, so he didn't stand out. But when they communicated with him, there was absolutely nothing out of the ordinary. There was nothing that affected them in the pit of their stomach. They weren't thinking instinct-wise, there was something bad about this human being. Absolutely not. What they did note, though, was during the last few days that they essentially knew him in school, before the crime that we're talking about actually occurs, something shifted. He'd become really quiet, really withdrawn. They felt that he had changed completely in those last few days. Now, it's also worth noting that when people reflect on an individual's behaviour and they know with certainty what that individual did, it can skew the way that they perceive that person. So looking back, they could say, oh yeah, he was really withdrawn, he was really quiet, but if something terrible hadn't occurred, they may not have reflected on that way. But we'll take it verbatim that they feel there was a shift and a change in his behaviour. However, it's also worth noting that certainly what happens on the day that Colleen is murdered is a complete deviation, according to those who know Chisholm, from his past behaviour and actions. Because she's just teaching. She's just going about her business, being the inspirational, happy, sunny disposition Colleen. And there is absolutely no way on God's earth that any of the behaviours that Chisholm has displayed could have prepared Colleen for the plan that he had. Because that particular day, he arrived at school with several bags, which he left in his locker. And those bags contained a kill kit, a ski mask, gloves, multiple changes of clothes, and a box cutter. Now, a box cutter, for those of you who don't know, is like a Stanley knife. So very, very sharp blade. And this is a plan that he's been working on for days. And that plan is something that he's just about to put into action. So when the class ended at 1:55 p.m, a few students stayed behind. This included Chisholm. Now, Colleen, she would often remain in school because she wanted to provide extra tuition to those kids that needed it. Again, what are we seeing about this incredible pro-social woman? She is so dedicated, actually at a cost, it appears, to her own well-being because she cares so deeply about these kids. Now, apparently, she'd actually asked Chisholm to remain behind. And the reason for that is he'd been caught doodling in his notebook as opposed to working. So she wanted him to stay behind so that he could, I imagine, catch up or have a conversation with her about his behaviour. Now, a female student who overheard Colleen and Chisholm talking said that they were talking about China. And this conversation moved on, and at some point Colleen mentioned Tennessee State. Now, bear in mind, Chisholm had just moved from Tennessee State. And she asked that question that we would absolutely anticipate asking if somebody was new in a school, building new relationships, dealing with a complete transition and change. She asks, "Do you miss home?" Now, at this point, according to witnesses, Chisholm became really, really annoyed and visibly upset. But apparently, initially, Colleen didn't actually notice this. But when she did, she quickly changes the subject. She doesn't want him upset. She knows that she's triggered something, and she clearly is upset that she's maybe triggered that feeling that she doesn't want to trigger, so she moves the conversation on. But the female student who was actually witnessing this exchange, she just felt that it hadn't been left behind, that Chisholm was still upset. And she also said that she looked at him when he was sitting by himself and he was talking to himself. Now, at this point, we could say, well, what's going on there? Because it's unusual behaviour when a young person is sat by themselves, talking to themselves. But it's not completely uncommon. We often have self-talk. Some of us do it internally in our heads. We know that voice, don't we? The one who's like, don't eat that cake, don't eat that cake, don't eat that cake. And then there's the other voice going, eat the cake, eat all the cake, get another cake as well. The point is, we have internal voices, not everyone, but a lot of us do. And then we have external voices. Certainly if I'm in situations where I just want to work something out, I'll often speak out loud, which is a little bit weird for the people around me. But it works for me. But when children are in distress, often a self-soothing mechanism is to kind of talk to yourself. You often see kids rocking as well in moments of distress. Like I said, if there is an emotional component to it, such as being upset because somebody is talking about something that's triggered a feeling of sadness, it's not atypical to sit alone chatting to yourself. You know, it can be weird to watch, but it happens. Again, we could also say, well, in psychotic breaks, that happens. When we see people dealing with schizophrenia and they go into a particular psychotic break, they might talk to themselves. You see people who are in mental distress talking to themselves, walking through the streets. If you see people who've got dependency issues, they'll often be talking to themselves, walking through the streets. So there are lots of situations where it is psychological and it is psychiatric, but there are also moments where it's just typical distress behaviour, and we cannot know which one of those two it was. Now, Danvers High School had recently undergone this incredible $71 million renovation. And this actually includes the installation of a really amazing security system, which is kind of how we're starting to see crime change, because often people are being videoed 24/7. So when they carry out a crime, they may not even be aware that literally they're being watched in every single angle. So you can piece together a crime in perfect time because the actual perpetrator is captured carrying out. So this incredible security system, at 2:54 p.m., it shows Colleen leaving a classroom. She's walking down the corridor. She's going to the ladies' toilets. That's on the second floor. At that point, she looks really happy. She's waving to someone in the corridor in that sunny disposition way. But almost immediately after, you see Chisholm. And he emerges from the classroom, but then he quickly ducks back inside. Then he reappears again. So he obviously doesn't want to be seen. And at this point, he follows Colleen into the school toilets. It's also worth noting that whilst he does that, he puts on his white gloves. He pulls his hood of his sweatshirt over his head and he actually checks his pocket to check for the box cutter. Can you imagine the premeditation there? Because we're going to have to decipher during this case what we truly think is going on with this young man. Are we talking about something like a psychotic break? Or are we talking about cold-blooded, premeditated execution? We see this playing out, that he's got the box cutter, that he's ready to go into the toilets, and that he's prepared. Now, a few minutes later, a female student actually goes into the toilets, but you see her immediately exit. And the reason for that is because when she walks in, she sees what she said was a naked brown butt. So she walks in and she can kind of see this bottom, somebody standing over and leaning over towards the sinks. And she also noticed that there's a pile of clothes on the floor that's beside them. But in her head, this is the female toilets. She just thinks that someone's gone in there, she's getting changed, and she doesn't want to intrude on that space, so she just leaves. I actually feel that it must be so sad for that individual who walked in. They probably have survivor guilt, that sense that they didn't alert anybody because there was somebody in there that they just thought was innocently getting changed, but actually this person is carrying out an absolute violent violation and murder. At the same time, a part of me is just really grateful that she didn't interrupt, because we're talking about an individual who is armed and dangerous and willing to kill. So how it would have played out for that individual witness if they'd actually confronted Chisholm during this particular attack, I can imagine it would have been an absolutely horrific experience for the witness, and they themselves might have lost their life. So we get to 3:07 p.m. Like, this is just 10 minutes later. Chisholm leaves the toilet. He's got hood over his head, and sickeningly, he has blood all over his hands. But there's no sign of Colleen. We've seen her go in there. We've seen him follow. He's come out covered in blood, and she's nowhere to be seen. Chisholm then goes outside to the student car park and then re-enters the school building at 3:09 p.m. But in that time, he's changed his clothes. So now he's wearing a white t-shirt. He's had the wherewithal to actually take different outfits in. Does that sound psychotic to you? And now he goes back into the classroom and he emerges at 3:11 p.m. with a red hooded sweatshirt over his head. So this is an individual who's trying to disguise himself. And at 3:16 p.m. he goes back to the toilet, and at this point he's actually gone and got a large blue recycling bin. And then 6 minutes later, so this is at 3:22 p.m, there's video of him basically wheeling the bin out of the toilets, going towards the elevator and then outside. Again, he's changed his clothes. He's now wearing a white t-shirt and a black ski mask. And I just think, imagine the presentation of that. A black ski mask. Intimidating, terrifying. Very much in line with those kind of characters in horror movies that you just would never wish to meet, because essentially it's not going to end well for you. What is the actual suggestion to the world that he's giving him wearing that? The footage then shows him wheeling that bin, and he wheels the bin towards a wooded area which is behind the school. Now again, 4 p.m, he's captured re-entering the school building. This time his jeans are literally covered in blood and he's not wearing any shoes whatsoever. Then he changes his appearance again, gets into different clothes, and this is all captured at 4:04 p.m. He's wearing shorts, black shirt, he's wearing glasses, but also he's carrying a pair of jeans with him. So this guy at this point doesn't seem to be in a very big rush, because he's coming and going. Then after a short while, he's seen again going back into the toilets. This is for a final time, and then he leaves the school grounds altogether. Now, there is another student's mother. Now, that mother said that they actually believed that they saw him running from the school. So that was reported to the principal afterwards. So it could be that at this moment in time, when he's finally finished, he wants to make a very quick getaway. It doesn't take long for Chisholm to be reported missing. So his mother, Diana Chisholm, is really concerned because at the end of the day, he has a particular habit and he doesn't get home on time. He doesn't get home at all. And therefore, she's instantly concerned that something terrible has happened to him. That's how a parent feels. When your child does not return home and is outside of the normal habits and they haven't informed you, the immediate suspicion is, oh my God, something terrible has happened to my child. And without a doubt, that's how his mother was feeling. She'd searched the school grounds for him. When she couldn't find him, this is around 6:34 p.m., she calls the police. And the police take it seriously. This is not in keeping with the expectation of this young person's behaviour. So they are worried. They start searching the area for him, which I think is a real positive. It says something about the particular police in this area that this mother at 6:34 p.m. has basically said, my son hasn't come home. And they're concerned enough to start searching. And at 9 p.m, the principal of Danvers High School, they send out a mass email to the high school staff because obviously they have a missing student. Now, shortly after this email goes out, a teacher contacts the principal. She's spoken to Colleen's parents, Tom and Peggy Ritzer. And at the same time that everyone's concentrating their focus on this missing boy, it turns out Colleen hasn't returned home either. And Tom and Peggy, her parents, are really worried. This is completely outside of her behaviour. It's out of character for her to change her routine without telling anyone. She's incredibly responsible. There is no way, as far as they are concerned, that she would not have come home. Therefore, they are immediately concerned that something bad has happened to her. So this is really concerning because they don't know what's happened. But when they start to investigate just a little bit more, they find that Colleen's car is still in the car park. So this is really worrying because why would it be there and she wouldn't be there? So her parents and the principal, they just start searching for her. Of course they do. They're convinced that she's going to turn up or that maybe she's incapacitated in some way. Maybe she's an accident. Maybe she's unwell. They just need to find her. But they can't. So when they finally realise that she isn't anywhere to be seen, they report her missing to the police. This is around 11:20 p.m. We have, whilst all of this is going on as far as Colleen's family, a young man who is now, as far as the police are concerned, missing, just carrying on about his business. So what does Chisholm do after this horrific crime that I described earlier? Well, he goes and gets fast food. Yeah, he goes and eats. And then he goes to the AMC cinema because he wants to watch the movie Gravity. Now, some sympathetic people could say, well, maybe he's not processing the world properly. Maybe he's numb. Maybe he's shocked. Maybe he's having some kind of out-of-body experience and he needs to ground himself. So he goes and does something that's ordinary. He goes and gets food. He goes to the cinema. But, you know, if you want to give that sympathetic mindset to it, what we wouldn't expect to see within it is a malevolence in the behaviour. And there is, because he uses Colleen's credit card to pay for everything. He's killed this woman, this teacher who cares deeply about all of these children, including him. And then he's actually exploiting her financially after he's carried out the most heinous of attacks. Now, they know this because of the digital footprint. And when he went and saw that movie Gravity, he was actually the only person in it at 4:30 p.m. because they're able to trace and track that back. Also probably doesn't bode well for that particular movie, with respect. So let's fast forward to 12:30 a.m. that night. Officers spot this young male and he's walking on a nearby highway in Topsfield. They notice that he's wearing shorts, a zip-up sweatshirt, black knee socks and trainers. Now, initially, they've got absolutely no idea who this young person is. The clothing seems inappropriate for that time of year, and they are interested and intrigued enough to actually stop the youth and to have a conversation with him. So the officer asks him, where are you going? And this youth says, nowhere. Then he says, well, where have you come from? And he replies, Tennessee. Apparently, the young man is just staring straight ahead the whole time, as if the officer wasn't even there. He's answering the questions, but they see that he's quite vacant. Then they ask him where he lived. He says, "I've got no address." Tells them that he's been walking for days. The officer then asks him to empty his pockets, and at that point, this young man produces credit cards and driver's license in the name of Colleen Ritzer. Now, bear in mind, at this point, the police have absolutely no idea that Colleen has disappeared. All they're thinking is, hey, hang on, why have you got this woman's ID? Now, initially, he just says, oh, I found them at a Stop and Shop supermarket. But the officer straightaway says, okay, well, there isn't one in Topsfield. And at this point, the young man says, okay, I took them from her car. So he's thinking on his feet, but he's also massively implicating himself immediately. You do not want to say to anybody, particularly a law enforcement officer, I just basically stole them from somebody's car. Because I don't know, it's going to get you in trouble, isn't it? And it's certainly not going to deflect from the scenario and make them leave you alone. Anyway, this is what he says. And they actually only figure out who he is when they ask him his name. And at that moment in time, they realise this is the missing teenager, Philip Chisholm. They're obviously really elated at this moment in time, by the way. They've found this kid. Everyone's worried about this kid. Something terrible's happened to this kid. And suddenly, they've got this 14-year-old boy. He's safe. Yeah, he might be in a bit of trouble because of what he's done, but he's okay. They're going to be able to go and let his mother know it's all fine. We've found your son. But they have no understanding or awareness at this point that they've actually apprehended a murderer. Like I said, as far as they're concerned, they've got a kid who's been a bit naughty and maybe stolen from a car. Like I said, all they think at this moment is that they've got this kid who's done something naughty and now they're going to be able to return him home. Now, simultaneously, there are also officers who are actually looking specifically for Chisholm. They're at the high school. At this point, they are also advised at that high school that Colleen's gone missing. Now, you can imagine what's going through their heads. Could it be that this child and this teacher have ran off together? Could it be that this teacher has done something to this child? There must be all these suspicions just rolling around their heads because it just doesn't make sense. We have like the best teacher in the world just disappearing off the face of the planet. We've got this kid who nobody thinks could do anything wrong. A kid who doesn't seem to have any issues with violence. A kid who hasn't stood out for any negativity until this point. It won't be computing that there could be some kind of synergy between these two completely going missing because of something so dreadful and terrible. I'm sure there will be so many other biases in their heads that they won't be able to imagine for 1 minute that they're going to be dealing with a murder shortly. So the officers start searching around the school and then behind the school, which is a wooded area. And this is when things start to get really dark because they start finding various items belonging to Colleen, includes a bag, her shoes, but more disturbingly, items of blood-stained clothing in the bushes. They also find blood-stained white gloves. They discover a large recycle bin inside of which appears to be loads of blood. Also, blood is found in the women's toilets on the second floor of the school near Colleen's classroom. Once the officers were able to view the school's security video as well, they immediately were able to build a picture of exactly what had happened because they're able to see it playing out directly. Colleen walking into the toilets, followed by Chisholm. Chisholm coming out of the toilets, no sign of Colleen. Chisholm seen wheeling the recycling bin in and out of the toilets and off the school grounds. They're watching in horror as they see this wonderful human obliterated by this child. Chisholm, of course, has been now apprehended by the police. He isn't just simply taken home because he's admitted that he's committed a crime. As far as they're concerned, he's broken into somebody's car and stolen their ID. So he's taken to the police station. That's where they search him. And this is when they discover a knife. It actually transpires that he'd shoplifted that knife hours earlier. And then they search his backpack and they uncover a woman's purse. and it contains a woman's blue-green underwear. They also find a box cutter with reddish-brown staining on. And the officers are old school. They know what this is. They know it's blood. So they ask Chisholm directly, where's the blood come from? He replies, it's the girl's. His hands were also still absolutely covered in blood. It had dried, but they could tell. When the officers asked Chisholm who this girl was, Chisholm just responded, she's buried in the woods. The officers then asked that question that every officer is going to hope a positive response will come from. They said, could they still help her? And Chisholm replied, no. Obviously, the police are blindsided. They're dealing with something so far different from what they were imagining when they first stopped that unknown youth. We've gone from a kid who's missing to a murderer who's present. They start to interview him. His mother's present at this moment in time because obviously he's a minor, but apparently his demeanor absolutely shifts and changes during this particular time. And he becomes really hostile, uncomfortable, doesn't want to speak, particularly with his mother there. And actually, when she tries to speak to him, he just ignores her, mostly at least. So at one point, she actually offers to leave, and he says, then leave. I don't know why you're here. Now, I think we can all agree that a young person who's been caught for something so heinous is going to have a lot of feelings running around within their psyche and emotions. But this speaks of anger. I don't know why you're here. It's a denying of connection. Why would you be here? It's resentful. It's not, I've done a terrible thing. Why would you want to be here? I don't deserve the support. This is a really resentful comment. I don't know why you're here. For a mother, that would cut you to the core. Even if you were dealing with a child who had become a murderer, the fact that they're absolutely able in front of others to acknowledge that as far as they're concerned, there's no reason for you to be around them in this darkest of hour. She does what any mother who is decent would do in that moment. She says, I'm here because I love you. And he replied, I don't care. Wow. It's dark, isn't it? The idea that he can be so devoid of feeling in that moment and that he really is disassociated entirely from that relationship, at least in that experience with the police and with her. There's certainly no warmth there. So his mother leaves. And after she's gone, Chisholm literally says, I've got a dislike for her and everyone else. Even has a particular dislike, he says, for people who try to help him. And that also, as far as he's concerned, he didn't really have a sense of morality. So it doesn't seem that this guy hasn't got complete non-self-awareness. I mean, I think we can all agree, he really doesn't have a sense of morality. Also, what we're seeing again is resentment. I dislike her, my mother, I dislike everyone else. So essentially he's telling the police that he dislikes them, he dislikes people who try to help him, that he really doesn't get morality. So this is something insight-wise that suggests that even though his behavior hasn't been diabolical in the past, there's been something bubbling, something festering, something boiling, just waiting to bubble over in the right circumstances. One, of course, could argue a different point. They could suggest that maybe this young person feels a level of abandonment or a level of frustration about the abuse that they might have experienced as a child who has been thrown out of a world that he enjoyed when he lived in Tennessee and placed in a world that he doesn't feel a part of. He feels frustrated with everybody else making decisions about him and towards him so that he's built up this resistance to people and he's just decided that everybody is negative. And when somebody presents being positive towards him, it challenges him because he wants to see everybody as negative because it allows him to feel that feeling and project that resentment. And then somebody tries to break through that and be kind, and that just makes him feel less powerful because he thinks to himself, maybe it's me that's the problem. You know, maybe all those things that happened to me are terrible, but I'm forming this perception and I'm projecting this perception. And then this person is breaking and breaching that because they're being kind. And they're seeing something in me that I don't want to see, which is the goodness. That could also be a psychological reason why he has such an issue with people being kind. But like I said, it could be more basic than that. It could just be more of that antisocial behavior within him. He doesn't actually tell the police why he feels this way, what it is that makes him feel so resentful of the human being. But what he does say to the police is this: after she insulted me, that's when I became the teacher. So he feels a level of humiliation at the hands of his teacher, apparently. Although we can all agree there was absolutely nothing that his teacher did that would have been humiliating. It's completely out of context with the way that this woman is. But if you're looking to be offended, oh my God, let's all be honest. If people are looking to be offended these days, they can be offended at, I don't know, running water. It's running too fast. It's running too slow. It's running in a way that feels distinctly average. I'm offended. You can always find offense everywhere. Believe me. Just one look on Twitter and you'll be able to engage with the reality that 97% at least of the people on there are offended by air. Just air. Air, water, anything that's required for life. It'll offend somebody. But anyway, I digress. But we're seeing, like I said, this sense of him looking for a reason to act out a behavior that he wishes to act out. And then during that interview, as he's talking about what's going on, he then starts to confess to the fact that he's killed his maths teacher. And actually he describes in pretty deep detail how he attacked her in the school toilets, how he punched her in the face, how he slashed her throat before raping her. Then talked about how he removed the body in the recycle bin. And he claimed at that point that he cut her twice, but the autopsy, which I'll go through shortly, demonstrates that's an absolute lie. He also went into detail with the police about how he cut the artery in her neck and how he knew exactly where he could do that and what would happen when he did that. He stated, the way it works, it's kind of like a dragon's kiss. The blood all rushes up. And so when I hit her, it's a lot. It's more than a lot of blood. That's got glee in it, hasn't it? That's not somebody who's horrified, ashamed. That's somebody who wants to relive it. It's somebody who's proud of the event. It's somebody that's obviously planned on cutting in a certain area and had an expectation that there'd be a lot of blood, but maybe it was even more blood than they anticipated. But it's not aversion. It's not horror. It's not a sense of, oh my God, what have I done? It was horrifying seeing all that blood come up. It's not that coming to the senses. It's the celebration. The description to the police is not running from it. It's running to it. I feel like there's a level of pride in his work. Also, he goes on to tell the police where they'll be able to find the body, even draws a diagram. And one of the things that he said to the police was he wanted to humiliate Colleen, so he removed her underwear to do that. Also explained that he'd smashed both his and her mobile phones because he was concerned he was going to be traced via GPS. Just going to throw it out there. Just going to throw it out there, Chisholm. Probably just going to suggest this. If you're going to try to be sophisticated on a forensic level by smashing your phones up, you probably want to avoid being captured 24/7 the entire time on CCTV in Technicolor. Just putting it out there. Anyway, this is what he's telling the police. And again, there's that level of desirability as far as he is concerned to be seen as a real criminal, a real murderer, that he'd actually got some planning put into this. There's somebody who's actually thought it through. They actually did go on to recover both of the phones. They were near the cinema that he'd gone to. But like I said, it's so far outside the realms of sophistication because he's literally been pictured throughout actually going ahead through the motions of that murder. Now, whilst the detectives are continuing to interview Chisholm, they relay the information to the search team, of course, who are desperately at this point looking for Colleen because they know that it's highly likely that she's very badly injured or, of course, worse. We get to about 3 a.m. in the morning and the officer notices an area of disturbed ground in the woods behind the school. He's got a really powerful torch, so he goes over to take a look and he actually spots a toe sticking out of the ground, and it's a nail that's painted pink, her favourite colour. It takes them only moments to uncover Colleen's body, which has been put in a shallow grave, been covered up with just leaves and debris. What's really haunting for me is we're talking about a 14-year-old child. 14. And yet this young man had left Colleen's body not just in a shallow grave, not just horrifically abused because of what he'd done to her before. He'd left her in a sexual position in that grave. He'd posed her. She was lying face up, her legs apart, naked from the waist down, and her bra had been pulled up. But if that isn't too terrifying to imagine when we're thinking about the context of the chronology of this child, he'd also taken a large tree branch and inserted it into her vagina. This is about traumatizing the individual who finds her, as well as humiliating her corpse. They were able to discover very quickly that she'd been raped and that she'd been stabbed multiple times. And there was a really deep gash and really severe damage to her throat. When they looked at what the injuries were, they were able to establish that her throat had been cut so severely, so savagely, that her vertebrae had been chipped. Just envisage, imagine the level of aggression in slicing so deep that a vertebrae had been chipped. They were also, thankfully, although this wasn't really that necessary because of all the information that you've got on CCTV, but it was really to some degree helpful on a DNA level, that they were able to find sperm cells from her body, which were consistent with the Y profile of Chisholm. Next to her body, they actually found a neatly handwritten note reading, "I hate you all." How planned was this? "I hate you all," next to her body. They also found a backpack at the scene, and that had Chisholm's school ID sitting on top of it. This young person, as much as he smashed the phones, I don't think there was ever real intent to get away with it. I think he always knew he was going to get caught. The fact that he left that signature, "I hate you all," the fact that he posed the body in such a way that would have obviously demonstrated a danger to society like no other, the fact that he's on CCTV, the fact that when the police catch him, he doesn't actually deny that he's been involved in some criminal behaviour, the fact that he admits it all when he gets taken in. I don't think this was ever about doing anything other than killing. That was his main priority, his main concern. Whatever happens after is inconsequential, because he's got away with what he wanted to get away with. The execution, rape, and murder of a teacher who was completely innocent, who was just in potentially the wrong place and the wrong time, just an object as far as this boy was concerned to carry out his warped desires, to play out his darkest and most deviant of fantasies. The autopsy, I'm sure you've already established, by the way, how she died. She bled to death because of that stab and slash wounds that we were talking about to her neck. But he said that he'd cut her twice. BS. He'd slashed her 16 times. She'd also been strangled. You're talking about an absolutely horrific murder. And one of the big tragedies in this case as well, when we're trying to piece together a picture of how she was murdered, is that they lost so much forensic evidence from the school toilets. So Chisholm left the school toilets, and afterwards a cleaner goes in. They go in to get it sorted. And when that cleaner walks in, obviously they're greeted with the most absolutely heinous bloodbath of a place. Bear in mind that Chisholm has already talked about the amount of blood. You know, he's made a big deal of saying how much blood there was there. And we're talking about the toilets being the origin of the murder. So it's going to be covered. So that place is like literally a slaughterhouse. Now, that cleaner walks in, sees it, can't believe it. They're dealing with a bloodbath. But their first language isn't actually English. So they know that something terrible's happened. And so they want to go notify somebody straight away. And they go to the school custodian. And they explain in broken English that there's this large amount of blood in the women's toilets. Unfortunately, because of the language barrier, the custodian mishears and thinks that the cleaner says there's a lot of blue in the toilets. And that custodian just thinks, oh, right, okay, there must be some kind of cleaner fluid that's gone over the floor in the toilets. It's spilled out. So they just say to the cleaner, clean it up. And that cleaner does. They do exactly what they're told. And subsequently, the majority of the blood at the crime scene had been removed with a hose. On one level, do we need that evidence? No, we don't. But it also demonstrates how those sliding doors moments could make such a massive difference to a case. If we didn't have all of the other stuff, the CCTV, etc., the admission, etc., we could be in real dire straits if pretty much the entire murder scene has been cleaned up. And one of those things that you can hardly conceptualize, that clearly the cleaner's saying something really bad's happened and the custodian's got it wrong and the cleaner wants to just do the right thing and do exactly what they're told by their manager, and they do. And yet, how things could have played out differently if we didn't have all the other evidence. Now, Chisholm at this point is charged with murder, aggravated rape and armed robbery. And what does he do? Bear in mind all the stuff that we've got. Bear in mind, you know, he's not going to be able to get away with this, guys. Under any universe, in any dimension, even if we find time travel and we realise that string theory is correct, he's not getting away with it, is he? But he decides, I'm not going to get away with it. I'm going to say, I didn't know I was doing it. I'm guilty, but not really guilty, because I'm insane. So yeah, he goes, not guilty by reasons of insanity. Let me tell you, in the States, that is one tough, tough position to prove, which I like, because I don't think anyone should just be able to pull out that I'm mentally unwell. Because mentally unwell people do not go around killing people. Murderers go around killing people. Now, there is a fly in the ointment, so to speak, prior to the trial, because a court ruled that Chisholm's confession to police couldn't be admitted as evidence at the trial. The reason for this, they concluded, was that it had been coerced from him when basically he'd wished to remain silent. I don't know why they bother doing that. We're dealing with a technicality. He's bound to rights. They have him on video. He literally has all these different clothes connected to him. He's killed this poor woman, this incredible inspirational teacher. And they're like, oh, he wanted to stay silent, so we should just throw out his admission completely. What, and risk this woman, who's completely innocent, just a bystander in his world, somebody of great meaning to so many other people, you should just risk her not getting justice because this kid wanted to stay silent, but clearly didn't. They didn't have thumb screws on him, did they? They weren't waterboarding him. And we all know, without a shadow of a doubt, this would have been videotaped as an interrogation. So can we please all acknowledge the police were not threatening him? This kid didn't even want his mother in the room. He was pretty adept at saying what he wanted to do and what he didn't want to do. And I don't know about you, this doesn't seem like a kid who struggled to say what he thought. Let me take you back to his description of cutting her throat. I'm sorry. When they have technicalities like this, I'm sure the defense are really happy with them, but we're talking about the murder of a really well-loved woman, somebody so pro-social she would have changed kids' lives, and we're actually going to do that. I really don't respect any decisions made on that. And I don't respect the fact that the court felt it was appropriate to rule that Chisholm's confession to police couldn't be admitted. It's BS. He did it. He admitted it. It should absolutely be brought into trial. Now, thankfully, in this case that we're talking about, there was enough evidence elsewhere. And because of that, all the CCTV that was admissible, etc. Chisholm and Colleen's bloodstained clothing that they found, the box cutter they had actually used to kill her, these in themselves were enough to actually get into court and prove that there was a connection there. But like I said, the sliding doors moments, we've lost all the blood from the scene of the crime because of a mistake, just an error of judgment and a miscommunication, but now we've actually lost his confession. And this kid's saying, I'm not guilty, I was insane, wasn't me, was out of my mind at the time. Really, really worrying. Because a house of cards can fall with this kind of scenario playing out. So we get to November 2015. This is when the trial actually commences at Salem Superior Court. Chisholm is, in my opinion, fortunately tried as an adult. Now, this is in accordance with Massachusetts law. A lot of people will say, but he's only 14. And listen, I am all for second chances. I am all for young people being given the opportunity to change. Mary Bell is a great example in the UK of a young person who carried out horrific murders of children and still succeeded in rehabilitation and, according to sources, is living very well as a pro-social adult. Also, we can look at John Venables, a child who was found guilty of murdering James Bulger, who absolutely has reoffended and probably, I don't know, should never be let out ever again in the rest of their lives from prison. But we also look at his counterpart, which is Robert Thompson, who again is an individual who's apparently in a long-term living relationship and is doing well. It does happen, whether we buy into it being okay to rehabilitate these individuals or whether we disagree entirely. What we can say evidentially is it is possible for young people to do horrible things and transform. We all have our views on that. Some of us have views that others would disagree with because they're not necessarily seen as involving human rights, because we would just like them put somewhere and left forever. But others genuinely believe that there is a chance to rehabilitate. And I tend to come down on the side of the crime is everything. If I look at a crime and I think, okay, is it possible that that was spur of the moment? Is it possible that that was a break from reality? Because that happens very occasionally. Then maybe. Because at the end of the day, the system should be to try to rehabilitate. But when I look at this crime, I think you should not be tried as a child. If you had the wherewithal to pack a kill kit, the wherewithal to take time doing what you did, the wherewithal to recount it in such a way that you felt a level of pride, I don't think you should be tried as a child. I think that you carried out a crime with such malice and such intent and such premeditation that you are very, very dangerous. And if you're going to be tried, you should be tried in a place and a position where the sentence fits the crime. So this is what happens. Now the defense, well, they do admit, because they won't have any other choice but to admit, that Chisholm had actually done exactly what he was accused of. But their argument, of course, is, but he didn't know he was doing it. He was in a psychotic episode. And that's the only rational explanation for these actions. Now, apparently, I will also say that they brought in the fact that his family allegedly had a history of mental illness. So they're kind of saying, okay, let's look demographically at the historical experience of the family. Ooh, there were these issues with mental illness. Therefore, that's going to explain away the actions of this young person. Well, let's just think that through. Were all the family out just murdering individuals for their own satisfaction? I doubt it. I doubt there was any evidence of mental illness that led to murderous intent and realities. Throwing it out there. I have a family, and my family has a history of mental illness. Severe psychotic breaks, for example. Am I out there right now doing things like murdering individuals because I'm having a bad day? No, I'm not. Because that's not what mental illness does. I'm not saying that murderers don't also have mental illnesses. I'm just saying that's not what makes them the murderer. But this is what they're throwing in. He didn't know what he was doing. Did he not? No. He had no idea what he was doing. Are you absolutely sure that he didn't have any idea? No. Totally irrational. Was he really irrational? Absolutely so irrational that if irrational was a definition in an actual dictionary, with a picture, it would have his face on it. That's how irrational. He literally packed a kill kit. Totally, totally irrationally packed. He seemed to have everything in order. It didn't seem very irrational. It was irrational. He changed his clothes several times and took them to the scene. He did do that, but that was irrationally coordinated. If you look, there were really discoordinated clothing, which demonstrates irrationality. He took a box cutter with him. He was so irrational that he believed he was a worker at a local supermarket and needed to open boxes. You're just talking bollocks, aren't you? I might be. I think I am talking bollocks, but I'm going with this because Jen in the office says, otherwise there's absolutely no way anyone's going to believe this kid was anything but the devil itself incarnate. You need to get another job. I don't think it probably went like that, but you know, I'm a little bit triggered on this. The defence really annoys me at this point because this idea that there's some kind of fundamental relational experience with mental illness and that's the reason that he did this, nah, nada, not a chance.
What is this case about? This case is about why did this happen? Why did a 14-year-old boy, well-behaved, quiet, 1 month into high school, do these terrible things? The answer is he was severely mentally ill. He had been suffering from a psychotic disorder since the age of 10.
But this is what the defence are going for. And of course, they're able to provide psychiatric evidence, apparently, that Chisholm had heard voices since the age of 10. Let me tell you, if hearing voices is a major issue that symbolises your connection with the potential murders of people, a lot of people will be dead. A lot of us have voices in our heads that might not be that sense of a person standing next to you or outside of you having a conversation or actually hearing loud voices that feel alien to us in our heads. But let's be honest, a lot of us have got voices in our heads that have little chats with us regularly. That doesn't make it a psychiatric issue. And even if it was a psychiatric issue where somebody is dealing with schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, psychosis, and these voices can be present, the idea that the presence of the voice leads to the murder of a teacher, I'm sorry, it does not transmute. Thoughts do not become actions. In the vast 99.999% majority of cases where mental illness is concerned, unless it's about harming the self. Yes, if you are mentally unstable because you're dealing with some of these horrific feelings and thoughts, you will at times be a danger to you. Drives me crazy that we're constantly trying to put mental illness into the criminal paradigm as if there's some kind of reality that people who are struggling already are out there trying to cause problems for the rest of the world. It's just not reality-based. So we have this defense expert and they say that he's psychotic and depressed. So not antisocial and murderous. No, he was just psychotic and depressed.
Now, at the end of his stay in 2015, did you reach a diagnosis for Philip Chisholm?
I did.
And what was that diagnosis?
I made two diagnoses. One was a depressive state, best described in my view as a major depressive state, and another was a brief or transient psychotic episode.
Now, the prosecution, obviously, they're going to go for the absolute opposite. They say he was not crazy. That was the word that they used to describe his actions. They said this kid wasn't crazy. He was focused. He had an absolute clear plan. He had the foresight to go to school armed with a box cutter. He had the foresight to go to school with changes of clothes. The prosecutor actually said this. He had a goal, a terrible, terrible purpose, and he played it out in the woods, and he didn't care what came after that.
And Dr. Heaven, what were the results of Philip Chisholm's MMPI for adolescents?
The results suggested that it was likely invalid because his F minus K scale was excessively elevated and suggested that he was attempting to fake bad and to demonstrate that he was severely mentally ill.
And I agree with that. I believe fully, as I said earlier on, this is not an individual concerned about consequences. This is an individual more concerned about playing out the fantasy that he has created in his head. We don't know how long that fantasy existed, but that fantasy is dark, malevolent, and probably has festered for a long period of time. So this prosecutor is saying, this kid just wanted to do what he did. He didn't care about getting away with it, because ultimately he lived out exactly what he wished to live out. And he supports this theory that this kid didn't care about getting caught, because he said after battering, brutalizing, violating, murdering Colleen, he even left his ID at the scene. It's almost like a, I did this. And the prosecution go as far as to say that they are convinced that was his signature. So not only did he leave the handwritten note, he literally left his calling card. It was me. I want you to know it was me. And when you think about serial killers, you think about a signature being left serving their emotional and psychological needs. Certainly, that seems to resonate with me. Does it resonate with you? Also, the prosecution, they propose that Colleen may not actually have died following the initial attack in the school toilet. They put forward the possibility that she could well have been killed later in the woods, which is just too terrible to imagine, isn't it? The prosecution suggested that Colleen was incapacitated in the toilet, so she was overwhelmed by this individual, she was overpowered. But because Chisholm hadn't had the chance to do exactly what he wanted to do to her, because he was interrupted, potentially when the girl walked into the toilets, he wanted time. And that's why he dumped her in the bin. And then he took her to the woods because he wanted to finish the job. And they put forward the idea that this is where he sexually assaulted her and it's where he repeatedly slashed her neck. The prosecution said Chisholm was manipulative, he was a liar, and he was somebody who'd just gone out of his way to claim, I've had a psychotic episode, because he wanted to justify his actions, he wanted to mitigate the sentence, he wanted to avoid responsibility. And if that's the case, again, that adds into the antisocial behaviour, the antisocial personality, the malevolence, the willingness to kind of deflect, distort, change reality to avoid the sentence that he deserved. Now, two psychologists, these mental health experts for the prosecution, they both straight up said, this young man is sane. He's trying to fake mental illness. He's doing a really bad job of it. But at the end of the day, he is completely sane. Now, in this case, the jury, to some degree, had a relatively difficult decision because they have to decide whether Chisholm gets detained in a secure mental hospital or a prison. And I think for lots of people on a jury, they may well think to themselves, well, this is a kid. Kids don't do this kind of stuff. Kids don't go around killing their teachers and sexually violating them this way. This is something that requires treatment, and often you will find that in cases like this, there is a more sympathetic reality to the sentencing, as in they definitely deserve to go to prison, but not a prison that doesn't have medical attention. So therefore a mental hospital that's secure could be the answer. And I guess that the family of Colleen are probably sitting there thinking that that is a potential reality. And I'm not saying that secure mental hospitals are a fun day out, I'm not. But I'm saying when you're not with the major prison population and there is more care available to you, that it is less likely to be as traumatic as going to an actual high security prison. So we get to the 15th of December, 2015, they reach the decision. The jury of 8 men and 4 women, and they find Chisholm guilty of Colleen's first degree murder.
When something terrible happens, people will often say it could always be worse. It is difficult for this court to imagine what could be worse for an individual or a family to endure than the brutal and senseless murder of Colleen Ritzer. Colleen Ritzer lived a life of quiet heroism. That's what most teachers do. Henry Adams observed that a teacher affects eternity. She can never tell where her influence starts. Colleen Ritzer's parents, more than most, have learned the reach of their daughter's influence. but at a cost no parent should have to endure. While the extent or lack of extent of the defendant's mental health was the subject of exhaustive testimony at trial, the Commonwealth presented overwhelming evidence that the defendant had substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct and had the substantial capacity to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. I will punish the defendant for the murder of Colleen Ritzer, and I will punish him for the rape as well as the armed robbery of the underpants she put on the morning of her death. But I may not utilize the horrific rape and robbery of Colleen Ritzer to punish the defendant for this unspeakable murder more than the law allows.
He's also convicted of one count of aggravated rape and armed robbery. Interestingly, the additional aggravated rape charge, which involved the tree branch that I talked about earlier, they dropped that. And the reason for that was they couldn't actually prove that Colleen was still alive when this occurred. So they couldn't say it was actual rape because it would be more violation of a corpse. Personally, I say throw the entire book at him. Or the tree. Throw the tree at him. Get large branch, throw at his head. Just going to throw it out there. Rough justice, one could say. Rough justice. Timber is quite rough though, so that could actually be contextual. It could be a nice little parallel and metaphor, all in the same moment. When that was read out, that he was guilty as hell, showed no emotion. Why should we be surprised that an individual devoid of emotion fails to show emotion in this moment in time? Now, his mother, on the other hand, who, bear in mind, is a victim in this as well, without a shadow of a doubt, I can't imagine what it would be like to find out that your kid is a callous murderer, a rapist, and an executioner of an incredible woman. It must be heinous. But she appeared to faint in her seat. So again, what we can see is typical behaviour versus atypical behaviour. She's acting normally, whereas he's totally disassociated. We get to the 26th of February 2016. At this point, Chisholm is sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 40 years.
This court will impose the mandatory life sentence for the murder of Colleen Ritzer and set a parole eligibility date of 25 years, the highest level our law allows. This court will impose a concurrent sentence of 40 years to 40 years and one day for the rape of Colleen Ritzer and a concurrent sentence of 40 years to 40 years and one day for the armed robbery.
Now, that's a long time, right? We can all sit here and agree that 40 years is a long time to spend in prison. Is it a redeemable scenario where somebody could be institutionalized that long and come out into our society a better person? I don't know. What I would say is he's only going to be 54 by the time he gets eligible for parole. And we can take a step back and just like look at that. Because if you're a woman at the age of 54 years of age, it's going to be difficult for you to think about having a family, for example, because you're 54. But at 54 years of age, a man is capable of having kids. A man is capable of having a relationship with somebody younger and building a life with them. And there's a little bit of me that thinks, how is that denied Colleen and yet is potentially available for this murderer? It really makes you think, because often when we cover cases on this channel, we're talking about a 50-year-old going down for 50 years. We're talking about a 38-year-old going down for 40 years, and we're suddenly in a different ballpark where you're like, you know what? You cost somebody their life, you're gonna pay with your at least freedom for life. But we're not talking about that right now. 54 has half a life ahead of them. It's a long time to be free. The judge stated this at the sentencing. Colleen Ritzer lived a life of quiet heroism. The crashing waves of this tragedy will never wane. It's beautiful and tragic, what he says. It's poetic, but there feels little poetic justice for Colleen's family. In the victim impact statement, Colleen's younger brother Dan stated this. You do not know pain until you are forced to watch someone you love lowered into the ground. You do not know pain until you watch all those around you collapse to the ground in tears. Put this animal behind bars for the maximum possible sentence. Colleen's mother, who adored her daughter, so Peggy, she stated that she was absolutely broken. I think anyone can relate to how that must be. We can't truly understand the gravity of desperation, desolation, horror, and loss of losing a child in such tragic ways. But you can imagine dipping your toe in the horror of that feeling by just relating to other losses and then amplifying them by a million. For Peggy, it's real. It happened. She said, "Now I isolate myself from people I love because pretending to be happy is so difficult." I totally concur with that. Completely connect with what she's saying there. And Colleen's beloved father, Tom, he said this, and this just is excruciating. It's truly excruciating. He said, "I didn't protect Colleen. A dad's job is to fix things. I would do anything I could if I could fix this for Colleen." Again, just a statement of such reality. We know that as a loving father, he would kill, he would protect, he would create, he would do whatever it took to keep his girl safe. And to have to live with the legacy of such loss and the powerlessness of not being able to protect is something that he must breathe in and out a million times a day. I think we all agree that for Colleen's family, it must be a cross so difficult to bear, a burden so incredibly challenging to carry. During the trial, Chisholm displayed absolutely no remorse for his actions. He apparently, just to let you know a little bit more about this, had to be removed from court many, many times because of his behaviour. On other occasions, he actually refused to even go to the hearings. Just conceptualise that a minute. Let it process. This is a child with no history of violence that suddenly mutilated, raped, murdered his teacher, and then showed absolutely no remorse for it. Actually behaved incomprehensibly in court, disrespectfully to the degree where he wouldn't even attend. This is an individual who it feels has been festering beneath the surface and then erupted. And now he's who he truly is. That's not psychotic. That's psychopathic. Let's not confuse the two. I said at the very beginning that when a child kills, it's really difficult to get your head around because they are such incredibly rare crimes. Also, when you think about the crime itself, it's got to be one of the rarest types. This is a kid who committed the crime in the school, in the daytime, when other people were around. I mean, we don't know what it was that triggered Chisholm. We might never know. The only detail that he would not elaborate on to some degree is what that trigger was. But the note that he left alongside his victim's body, the fact that he said about how he felt about the world in general, "I hate you all," is very much in line with some of the statements that have been left, for example, by school shooters. This malevolence, this despising of the population, a feeling that the world has hurt them and therefore the world needs to be hurt, as opposed to internalizing and using it against themselves. It's an externalization. It's an anger, a rage, a how do I take these unmanageable feelings and manage them by harming others. Now, when he was first arrested, they actually spoke to his former girlfriend. That was the person that he dated in Clarksville before he'd moved to Danvers. And she could not in any way, shape or form, connect with the idea that he was guilty. She actually stated this: "Philip has never been the guy to get angry. He takes all his anger out on skateboarding. Someone doesn't just wake up one day and say, I'm gonna kill my teacher." I mean, with respect, they do. That's exactly what people do. I completely understand why his girlfriend would say that, because her experience of this young man was of a kind young man, but she talks about the fact that he used the skateboard to take his anger out. Well, that means that she sees that there was anger there. It was within him. Yes, he was using a productive mechanism to actually expel it. But when you have this rage inside, sometimes you're using a distraction, something that can stop you acting on those feelings, but the feelings are building and building and building and building, and then they burst. It was within him. And people do wake up and decide to do things that are absolutely heinous. We see that time and time and time again. People can plan for years, premeditate for years, and everyone around them thinks they're the nicest person in the world, and they haven't got any problems. Some can do that till they're 30. This kid only got to 14. So what we're seeing is that at the very moment that he reaches a level of being a young adult, the very beginning, he explodes. The statement shouldn't be someone doesn't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to kill my teacher. The statement should be he woke up and finally allowed himself to be the person that he'd always been building to be. That's why he killed his teacher. Because he woke up one day and decided, today's the day. And he only made it to 14 years of age before allowing that to play out. It's absolutely clear from what we talked about today that Chisholm had planned to harm someone that day. Now, whether it was planned for Colleen, whether she was always going to be the intended victim, we don't actually know, because he didn't actually know she was going to keep him behind after class with respect. So it could just have been one of those horrible sliding doors episodes where she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But what I will also note is in the research that I came up with, the police did investigate the possibility that Chisholm was actually infatuated with her. I mean, she was a really attractive young woman. She was caring. She was really approachable. Could have been that he misinterpreted the reality of that and he sexualized it. What I will note is that he's refused to elaborate on his motive. And that says to me that there is something very sexually orientated and he knows it. He knows that if he tells people why he wanted to choose her, that it will even more amplify the darkness of his nature. So I think he holds it back. And I also think he likes the power. You don't really have any power when you're in prison. I mean, there are different levels of prisoner, but really at the end of the day, you're beholden to the guards and your sentence. So he keeps that potentially for himself, that only he knows the real answers, that only he can free the information should he wish to, and that he can hold that over her family. We see that time and time again with these kind of killers. And whilst Chisholm up until the killing hadn't shown apparently any extreme violence, well, it doesn't happen to be an isolated incident, because when he was in custody at the Metro Youth Services facility in Boston in June 2014, he attacked another woman who worked at his secure unit. Yes, bear in mind, he attacked a woman. So somebody who's gonna be physically less strong than him. He's 6'2", remember? This young person is imposing, but he goes for a female. So he did it in a really, really manipulative way as well. So after he knew he wasn't being watched, he took off his shoes because then he could creep quietly and follow the 29-year-old Department of Youth Services counselor into the locker room. At this point, he pushes her against the bathroom wall, chokes her, hits her head with his fists, and then manages to stab her in the back with a pencil before the other staff were able to restrain him. Now, he was subsequently charged with attempted murder, and I think we can all agree just from that description, it is horrifyingly similar to the attack on Colleen. Also speaks to a lack of security in that situation. We're talking about high profile individuals with great levels of potential harm being around women that they can get access to. That is something that needs to be dealt with. So after this attack, he's basically sent to Worcester State Hospital in an apparent psychotic state. Yeah, apparently he was psychotic. Was he psychotic though? Yeah, he was totally psychotic. Was he though? Was he out of his mind? Did he not know what's going on? Was he suspicious and paranoid? Not exactly. He just was quite cunning. Was he quite cunning? Did he remove his shoes so he wouldn't be heard creeping up on this poor counsellor? Well, he did do that, but he was definitely out of his mind. Was he out of his mind when it seems like it was premeditated, he planned it, and it went down pretty similarly to the Colleen's murder, aside from the fact that he didn't have a knife? Well, now you say that, it does sound a little bit premeditated, but we've just gone for psychotic. Sorry, were you the lawyer in the original trial defending him? I was. But then you told me I should get a different job, so how could I be involved in decision-making around this kind of stuff? You need to become unemployed. Yeah, apparently he was screaming incoherently, he was foaming at the mouth, and I think we can all imagine why. To me, he was not psychotic in any way, shape or form. This is a guy who wants to play the system, also wants to carry out yet another heinous attack on a woman. This is him living out his fantasy, and he thinks he's found a loophole. Not only can he go ahead and horrifically attack this woman, he probably didn't even get to do what he really wanted to do, which would have been sexual in nature and obviously far more macabre in the fact that he probably wanted to kill her, but also he's probably double whammying it. Well, I can do this and then get sent to a mental institute and then I won't have to actually serve my sentence in prison. Just throwing it out there, it's only my opinion, but that's what I see. I see highly manipulative behaviour. But I just want to bring it back to the person that matters most in this story, which is Colleen. The teacher who always took time for the kids who struggle, the teacher who would have had great legacy in this world by creating mathematicians of the future, by noticing kids who were struggling. She would have been infinitely important in our society because of her beliefs and skills. Just a few weeks before she was horrifically murdered, she posted on Pinterest a quote and it said, "The kids who need the most love will ask for it in the most unloving of ways." But I don't believe that Philip Chisholm is deserving of that analysis. I think that he's different. I don't think he needs love. I think he had love in his life. I'm not saying his life was easy. I'm not saying that he didn't get brutalized as a child by a parent who was restricted from seeing him because of that behavior. I'm saying that there was love there. Just think about his mum's reactions. I believe that there was a darkness and a psychopathic mindset in this young man that no amount of loving could truly have changed. And no one could have imagined when she put that quote on Pinterest that she had only weeks to live and that she would die in the most unloving of ways. Colleen's family, they continue to champion her legacy. They promote the positive, the kind, the loving values that she cherished in life. And they've actually gone ahead and established an incredible memorial scholarship. It's called the Colleen E. Ritzer Memorial Scholarship. And the whole point of this is to benefit graduating high school seniors who demonstrate a passion for teaching, academic excellence, and love of a family. So they've embodied everything that she was and placed it in a position where she lives on, and the opportunities that that academic scholarship creates ensures that she will teach others through that particular legacy. And that's powerful, isn't it? She can't be present in this world, but everything that she was and everything that she is now projected into other amazing teachers full of potential. And their family are going to carry that on to ensure that her message is spread far and wide. And also a good friend of Colleen's also started Kindness for Colleen. And that was a campaign where they encourage everyone to perform random acts of kindness in Colleen's honour on the 22nd of October each year. Doesn't that just show you how incredible this woman was, how loved she was, how her meaning in this world and her still meaning in this world is so far reaching? Now, whilst we might never know why Chisholm did what he did, what we absolutely do know is that the world lost an amazing person and an inspirational teacher because of his actions. She would have undoubtedly gone on to inspire and to touch so many lives of so many more students had she been given the chance. But she wasn't given that chance. She had it selfishly stolen by a 14-year-old boy with more malice in his spirit than a population of an entire country. He is rare, and he is incredibly dangerous. And I hope, in my heart, that when the parole board meet down the line, they question greatly whether a young man who killed once and certainly tried to kill again would ever be safe to walk the streets in his 50s. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.